Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
We're here on April 30th for Tamson and Dan Read the Paper.
And it's been 2 weeks since we've been on the air, so we have...
Yes, because Dan had to work.
Because Dan had to work, naturally. And so we have a lot of ground to cover. There's a lot of Broadway that we've seen and that has yet to be seen.
Not that much, really.
Oh, we got to get to it.
Well, we have a lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about. And number one on the list, we saw Present Laughter with Kevin Kline. Just the show we put our money where our mouth is. We said that's worth seeing, and we saw it. And, Tamson, how was it?
It was great. It was great. I was skeptical because Kevin Kline... kind of a physical humor guy.
Right.
I had in my mind, like, the Three Stooges.
Oh, come on. You know better than that.
But he was terrific.
Well, first of all, it's a Noel Coward play, so it's his own thing. It's you know, halfway to Oscar Wilde. A lot of physical comedy, as Tamson mentioned, a lot of very witty stuff. It's kind of hard to describe, really, in a way that does it justice, but it's hilariously funny.
And, you know, for some reason... even though it's that old, it still seemed modern. It did not seem dated.
Yeah.
Cynthia Nixon was great. The interplay between Cynthia Nixon.
Well, first of all, Cynthia Nixon was so great. Cynthia Nixon wasn't in it. So you're talking about Kate Burton, I think, right?
Sorry.
It's okay.
Why am I thinking of Cynthia Nixon?
We can't explore that on
okay,
the air.
All right.
Kate Burton was great. She played the very grounded wife of Kevin Kline, playing a very ham-handed actor. Really in the style of John Barrymore, a name that doesn't mean that much anymore, but you get the idea. It's sort of a Peter O'Toole type, if we can say that. And he's out there on the edge, acting all the time. Kate Burton totally grounded, reeling him back in all the time. And you have all these characters going in and out in the way you used to.
A little bit like you and me.
Maybe a lot like you and me. But it's also a lot like the plays in the 30s, even the Marx Brothers, with characters coming in and out and scenes getting out of control. People jumping over couches and coming in odd entrances and havoc on the stage.
Yeah, all the wacky stuff. But it worked.
So all we can say about that is go. If you get the chance, if you're in New York, I know our voice carries all the way across the globe. But if you get the chance, go. So then we saw something else, a whole different type. We saw The Price just a few days ago, which is an Arthur Miller play. Mostly serious, but funny in the first act.
Right, and the Times Review actually said this is probably Arthur Miller's funniest play, not a high bar. But Danny DeVito is in it, Mark Ruffalo, right. Tony Shalhoub, Jessica Hecht.
So they're all very capable, all very good. Mark Ruffalo, obviously the biggest name, but the others are a big name too. And Jessica Hecht's a great stage actor in New York. She doesn't do the Hollywood the others do. But it's a very fine cast, and it's basically a story of how the family kind of revisits what happened over the last decades, including one brother who's a successful surgeon, and the other who was a policeman. And
so what did you think of it?
I sort of thought it was worth seeing. I liked it. I think that your point about Arthur Miller and sense of humor is right on point. You don't ask a lot from Arthur Miller plays in terms of humor. And you got more than you thought you were going to get. In part, that was Danny DeVito, I think. At the end of the day, what we both observed, it gets a little confused. And this goes to my Arthur Miller theory. But what did you think of it before I start theorizing?
I'm not such an Arthur Miller girl.
An Arthur Miller girl?
To me, it's just a bunch of people just arguing about... family stuff, you know. We can do that on our own. We don't need to pay hundreds of dollars.
Well, we don't do it as well.
To me, it seemed quite dated. You made an interesting point about part of the storyline involves, you know, a policeman brother and a wealthy doctor brother.
Right. And this is actually very reminiscent of the story of Arthur Miller's family. So here's the theory that Tamson's getting to, and Arthur Miller he was a great playwright. He brings great craft. There's no question about it. But when he has plays that are about his life, and if this play was about his life, After the Fall was about his marriage to Marilyn Monroe, which we happen to see also, which was awful. And when he has plays about his life, they're so totally grounded that they feel that their significance is circumscribed by the set that you're staring at on the stage. And it's hard really to engage beyond that. When he has a play that's about something that has nothing to do with his life, like The Crucible, right? Salem, Massachusetts, 16-year-old girl screaming about people being witches. It's fantastic. Because he's not grounded. He's not earthbound.
But he swore this was not autobiographical.
He swore, but of course, silly.
I think of course it did.
I think he said the same thing about Arthur as well.
But anyway, what I was referring to is your thing about the policeman.
Well, that's true, too.
You know, that there's this conflict between, you know, the one brother giving up, you know, great possibilities to have a civil service job.
Right.
The play would
play differently today if you put it in today's sensibilities.
Because I think we perceive the job of a policeman as entirely different.
Now, maybe that's just the political correctness. I don't know. But today, the way it would play is that the doctor either he was considered righteous or he sold out, depending on what kind of procedures he did. But the policeman would look back with great pride as to having served on the force for 30 years, and you might look at that as a man of integrity and something to be proud of.
And this guy was a man of integrity.
He was a man of integrity, but clearly the conflict was he had nothing to look back on with pride because he was a policeman, just a civil servant.
Right, and his wife doesn't want to go out with him.
In his uniform.
Because
it's a sign of disrespect.
Yeah.
It shows they don't have any money, they don't have any place
in
society.
So that doesn't quite play today.
No,
I think so.
Okay, and we saw, just to show that I take Tamsin out all the time, we saw last night, constantly, a movie, a film, Their Finest, which had been recommended to us by various people, and it was excellent. Fair enough, Tamsin?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a British film or Welsh film or something.
Yeah, close
UK
enough.
Film.
Yeah, they said Welsh.
First of all, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautifully shot.
Right.
And the people look great.
Well, it's about... It's about England during the war.
Yes,
and
London.
London during the war. And they're filmmakers. They're raising the morale of the country. And it is both an extremely evocative depiction of life in wartime London.
Yes.
And it probably is.
But it's also a romance. It's a wonderful
one
romance.
One at a time. Okay. Grisly, gruesome, very serious. And they didn't sugarcoat the experience in London during the war. The air raids, people getting killed on the streets on a regular basis because they're subject to the Nazi bombing. So there's that piece. Then, as Tamsin says, the romance, and this woman, Gemma Atherton, plays the female protagonist. She's excellent. Not a person I'm particularly familiar with. You have Sam Claflin is the name of the male protagonist. But they're great. But it's also, at the same time, a send-up a little bit of the movies.
Right.
What the movies are and what they aren't.
Right.
And
Bill Nighy's in it.
And Bill Nighy's. Well, let's talk about Bill Nighy, because we've seen Bill Nighy on Broadway.
What do you want me to say about?
What do you think of him?
I think he's terrific. I always think he's going to be too much of a shtick, but it always works.
Right.
It always works. And again, he's playing sort of a has-been...
let's say ham-handed actor. whose career is renewed because all the young men are away to war. And he gets another chance at film. You know, we saw Bill Nighy. Don't you think it's fair to say that his biggest part, or maybe people most know him from, what was that movie? Love Actually. So he's in Love Actually, and he plays the rock star. Although you wouldn't have remembered him because it's a movie that had Liam Neeson and that had all these other male leads who were, much bigger names than he was. But he had this, he also did other things too. We saw him on Broadway. And I was trying to remember the name of that. You were saying that it was... I said it was Nightfall, but you said
no,
it wasn't.
No, I don't know.
here's the point. The way Bill Nighy acts is that he has these quirky movements, and he looks like a scarecrow. He looks like he's 6'6" with these long arms. We saw him outside the theater one time on Broadway afterwards. He's actually a very small man, but he's... I don't know how he does it. He's kind of magnetic.
He's larger than life.
He is. So anyway, we loved Their Finest.
Go see it.
All right. Museum report, Tamsin.
Museum report. Well, I know I'm not going to talk about the Met anymore, but they are considering demanding admission.
It's called an admission charge.
Having an admission charge.
Or $25.
Yes. But possibly not for residents of New York City, just for outsiders. And this is done at some other places now, but so we'll see what happens. Keep posting.
I was shocked. Maybe I should have known this. I was shocked by reading about how much the Met is subsidized by the state and city government. And that's why anything they do is going to be reviewed by the state and city government.
Okay.
So.
Good.
Okay. I'm easily shocked.
And another museum update. In Philadelphia, actually, the whole museum area was consumed not by art, but by performance, that is to say the NFL draft, was actually staged in front of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It was a huge affair. It seems to have gone well.
Yeah. They said 100,000 people.
Hundreds of thousands.
Now, take it easy. It's 100,000 people.
I guess the draft used to be in just like some little venues, and that became a big deal and was in Radio City for a long time.
Right.
It was in Hope. And then a couple years it was in Chicago. And I read that this went well. Not saying they'll come back to Philly again, but they may rotate it to other cities.
Right. The silly thing is the draft is a non-event, but it's a triumph of people.
Well, how did your Giants do?
Well, they picked a guy who's a tight end who's okay in the first round. They picked some other guys. But the truth is, you don't really know how well you did. You can't evaluate it. But what's odd is there's a whole industry based on instant evaluation. So you have NFL personnel making, you know, pretty decent salaries. Let's call it $500,000 a year, maybe even more. All for the purpose of being able to identify, evaluate, and choose talent in the draft. And they all do their stuff in the draft, and with 15 minutes after the draft is over, you've got newspaper guys who are probably 10 minutes out of school grading the draft. Here's who got it right, here's who got it wrong. And the truth is, you don't know. As a matter of fact, you don't know for years. And I was telling Tamsin, one of the best examples of how odd the draft can be is the year, and I think I'm going to say it's 2004, where Aaron Rodgers was drafted. And the two top picks thought to be the top picks in draft going forward before it took place were Alex Smith and Aaron Rodgers, two quarterbacks. It's not unusual to take a quarterback right away. And who would go number one? Alex Smith went number one. San Francisco decided Alex Smith was the guy. They wanted to hitch their way.
So was Rodgers number two?
No, he wasn't two, he wasn't three, he wasn't four. And he's sitting there, and they have the top guys, or they thought to be top guys, sitting there waiting, maybe the top five or six guys. No one took him. No one took him in the top five, top 10. So the 24th pick. 24th pick, the Packers took him, even though they had no need for him. They had Brett Favre, and they took him. They said, what the heck? Everybody says he's pretty good. And they took him, and they put him on the bench for 4 years.
And it kind of worked out.
Best player in the year for the last 5 years. Alex Smith, by the way, still in the league.
You know, it'd be fun to look back at the other 23.
Not for the other general managers.
And see, you know.
Not for the other general managers.
Yeah.
But so people got it terribly wrong. Aaron Rodgers, far and away, the best player in that draft. Taken number 24. So you never know. Whatever your team did, don't worry about it. Maybe they know what they're doing.
The main thing is, I guess, just NFL. It's just another way of encouraging interest and publicity, etc.
But it's remarkable how successful they are. It's remarkable. You know, 100,000. I was joking, but that's the number I heard. That much interest in the
draft. They had all kinds of stuff going on for families.
Really?
Yeah. They had appearances by the players.
But the players, who cares about
I didn't go. Don't look at me. I mean,
it's amazing. The NFL really has a hold on the nation. There's no question about it.
And all right, so
you want to talk about
leeches.
Of course. Any opportunity.
Yes.
It's all yours. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, there's an article in the New York Times about leeches as a medicinal what would you call it? In medicinal use, are having a comeback.
Therapy. Leeches therapy.
Yeah, leeches therapy. Blood therapy. Apparently, they're very popular in Russia. Okay? Mm-hmm. And for various problems, for a variety of problems. And they put the leeches on you. Apparently, there's something in the venom in the leeches, so as they're sucking the blood, that actually functions as a blood thinner. Here's the deal. It's much cheaper to use leeches than a lot of other drugs. And leeches are pretty cheap in Russia. They're like 90 cents each. And some people who have ongoing problems actually have leeches. They sort of maintain the leeches in their house and reuse them. But if at the doctor's office, the leeches are not reused for sanitary purposes. But anyway, in the U.S., leeches run about $15.50 per leech. And the biggest supplier of leeches in the U.S. is actually something called Leeches USA.
Of course.
Headquartered in Westbury, New York.
Are you serious?
Yes. So
that's where I grew up, Westbury, New York. The center of leashes in the United States, I understand.
So now you know.
Yeah. Well, that does come to all to mind. We did see another article. We were talking about the journal today. We weren't going to go into it, but I'll mention just that the balance thing scientifically was the notion that developing a new chemical that would basically create reservoirs of water.
Out of air.
In other words,
is it powder?
The article says it replaces wells, potentially. They have yet to
somehow
develop this.
Draws water out of the humidity of the air.
That's right. You put it in some kind of foil thing, you shake it up, you let it out in the sun, and in the evening, you put it over a bucket, and you wake up in the morning, there's a bucket of water. So the thought is, instead of digging wells in certain parts of the world, you just spread this powder around.
I'm just nervous about the powder stuff.
Like, I wouldn't be too nervous.
What's in it?
It's kind of a miracle.
All right. It's
but
a miracle.
It's right up there with the leeches.
It's like, or this that pill that churns
the
water into gasoline or something.
The breath of what we're covering here.
Yeah.
So we're moving on all fronts. Speaking of which, perhaps the next frontier be on turning, creating water out of air would be a female head coach in the NBA. Tamsin brought this to my attention.
It was a nice article about Becky Hammon. Mm-hmm. Who is currently an assistant coach mm-hmm. for the
San Antonio Spurs. A men's basketball team.
Right. She just seemed like an interesting person.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty down to earth.
Yeah.
Played basketball in college.
Right. So look, I
played great basketball in college.
No. She played for Colorado State.
Yeah, Colorado State. Well, she broke a lot of records.
She's the Colorado State records.
Look. She's only 5'6".
Listen, I'm familiar with Becky. I used to take Sadie, as you well know, to New York Liberty games, and I saw Becky Hammon play for years. So Becky Hammon was what we call the off guard. The main guard was Sophia Witherspoon, who was very strong, close to 6 feet tall, powerful, very effective guard. And Becky was the off guard. She used to dart around as the sort of an undersized player, even for the WNBA, shoot baskets from long range, and actually led the team in scoring for several years. She was a good WNBA player, though she worked her way up it, but not a superstar.
She played in the Olympics.
She played in the Olympics, but for Russia.
For Russia.
She played for Russia.
For Russia.
And somebody said, well, why is she not playing for the U.S.? She said, no one invited me to the Olympic tryouts for the U.S. In Russia, they seem to be very interested in me. And to explain, she had been playing in the off-season in Russia, so they were familiar with her. And apparently the rules for qualifying for the Russian Olympic team are liberal, because I don't think she had much of a Russian background. But I think they finished third in the Olympics 1 year with Becky Hammon being the key. But in any event, she's very likable. She knows the game. And somehow the question has come up as to whether she could one day qualify as a head coach in the WNBA.
Mike Francesa,
the Pope, as he's known, on WFAN, his word is law. And
he says no way.
No way. And, you know,
this gal doesn't have a shot.
And the truth is, it's fun to give Francesa a hard time, but he's right. I mean, she's not going to be an NBA head coach. I can't say it's never going to happen, but she doesn't have that kind of background. She has I'm not saying she's not an effective assistant head coach, but the folks who succeed to become head coach in NBA have very serious, substantial backgrounds, usually as players, certainly many, many years in college as assistant coaches. It's not people who were hired as assistant coaches for a couple of years to become head coaches. It's not that way. And I think, actually, it probably would be tough for a woman to get into the NBA game as a head coach, put aside from whether she could command the respect of the players. I don't have any insight into that. But it is a very different game. And there are some things about the women's game that are probably useful in terms of thinking about how they might apply to the men's game. And that would be a plus. But on the other hand, it's probably a little hard to fathom every aspect of the challenges that you face in the men's game, because the men's game is very, very different from the women's game. So we'll see. But in any event, she rated a full page on the Wall Street Journal. So maybe there's some momentum.
Well, this is sort of a girl power conversation, which just reminds me of back to that movie we saw last night that was so good.
Yeah.
It has a little bit of girl power in it.
It did. It was not too subtle. It definitely had that.
And so, again, another reason, well handled, another reason to see it.
The character, at the center of that movie was multidimensional, very compelling.
Yeah.
And if Gemma Atherton wants to appear on our podcast to promote the movie, we're extending an open invitation. She can come by anytime. All right, another thing we want to talk about, the Times had an interesting article really about the day in the life of a fellow who operates a food truck, which was a very compelling and kind of complete narrative about what's involved in it.
Yeah, one of these little trucks, you know, not one of these, you know, gourmet, super cool trucks, but one of those little trucks with the...
chicken biryani and things like that.
And he's an immigrant from Bangladesh.
Right.
And it followed him around, you know, pays a guy to deliver the truck. Well, you see, if you're around Manhattan in the early hours, you see these trucks, coffee trucks and food trucks being delivered, carts really, not so much trucks, being delivered all over Midtown.
But that interested me. See, now I thought, you know, in a sense, I thought the job was almost more challenging because I thought if you're selling out of one of those trucks, you get up at dawn, you lug your cart up there, your truck or whatever, and you park in at the end of the day, you take it back. But everything's subcontracted. So he is subcontracted.
There's a guy who loads
the cart. First of all, somebody loads the cart with the foodstuffs he needs in the truck.
Right.
The cabbages, the lettuce, or whatever. It's all there. The knives, it's all there.
And then somebody delivers.
Somebody else delivers the truck. So he takes his train from Queens. He comes in at a respectable time because it's not the breakfast train, really. And it's all set for him to go. He walks in, and he has a strict routine.
He's chopping X amount of cabbage, X amount of onions. Making the food. It's not like he's just eating stuff.
But what's interesting is we discussed it. No chef background.
He's just cranking out the stuff.
He's manufacturing is the word he used. But he's an expert manufacturer. So he can manufacture 12 different dishes, 14 different dishes, and he sets it up that way, and it works.
And he has a partner that comes in later.
Right.
Then they handle the rush together.
Right, and they work together.
He's done by three. And but anyway, they say it clears about $125 a day.
He said he makes $120 a day. Okay, so that's just a word to the wise.
Maybe.
Not to get anyone in trouble, but when the Times reporter asks you how much you make, what you answer is what you write down on your tax return. What they really make, I don't know, but I kind of doubt it's $125 a day. But putting that aside, the $125 a day struck a chord with folks who were reading the article who noted that his great dream was to take his family on a Caribbean vacation.
Save up money so the family, the mother and the kids, go back and visit family in Bangladesh.
But what they wanted,
they dreamed
of the British Virgin Islands. So no sooner does they hit the paper when 3 days later someone sets up a crowdfunding site, and in fact there's $5,000 in the account
to
send them. So they'll be, you may run into them on your next Caribbean vacation.
So that was kind of a cute story.
It was. So we tend to talk about obituaries.
Turns out we're not the only people.
Yeah,
someone obsessed with obits.
That's right. Someone has made a film.
Yeah,
about
a documentary film about the writing of the obituary columns
In the New York Times.
In the New York Times,
of all places.
And it sounds pretty interesting. The standards they use, and you know, all the kind of research they do.
And they make the point. We haven't seen this film yet.
We'd like to.
They make the point in the
article.
We could go to New York. Yes. They make the point in the article that some of the best writing in the New York Times is in the obituaries, and I think that's true. And they talk about who the editors have been over the years, and they said it's just no coincidence. They have a certain style. They also talk about the hard decisions made as to who's going to be featured in obituaries, the length of the obituaries, the pressures in terms of assembling information in an unexpected passing. And it sounds pretty interesting.
The Times gives it a critic's pick.
Well, of course, it's about
the
Times.
So it's a film by Vanessa Gould, a documentary about the Times necrology team.
Necrology team.
Necrology.
Yeah, well, they're a team. So,
we have a couple of interesting obituaries.
We think there's something in the Times obituaries. We're just going to talk about a couple today, but the first is a fellow named Robert Pirsig, whose name might not be familiar, but he wrote the book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And that was an extremely famous book, and I still think the title is well known. But when it was
published in 1974?
Thereabouts, yeah, I think that's right. And it's kind of interesting. So it was tremendously popular. It is, at least superficially, about sort of making the connection between, internal development and machines and technology. It was really much more personal than that. Pirsig, in describing the situation, describing the book, was he said, you know, I don't know much, you know, again, on his surface, it was about a trip he took with his son from Minneapolis to California, I believe, on motorcycle. He said, look, I don't know that much about Zen, and I know even less about motorcycle maintenance, but it was his own philosophy. And his philosophy came from a funny place because he had had some difficult issues with schizophrenia. And as described in the obit, the book was partly an effort to make peace with himself after 2 years of hospital treatments, including electric shock therapy. And some of the story is sad. His son had some problems too and was later stabbed outside a Zen center where he was staying after being institutionalized to some degree before
stabbed to death.
Stabbed to death.
Yeah.
So he had a sad life. He also had a great difficulty in dealing with things generally and with people. The book became a cause celeb. He couldn't deal with that kind of publicity. He became a recluse. He continued to write, but he never had a successful book beyond that. I think to the end, he felt that his particular personal philosophy was never taken seriously. So all in all, not a very happy story. I mean, part of it was just such a great title. I mean, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I cannot think of a more evocative title until maybe some years later you would, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
But okay.
Those are two titles that come to mind. In any event, so he passed. There was another interesting obituary.
Yeah, well, the one that caught my eye was a one for a pest control magnate whose name was Truly Nolan. It's not totally clear where his name came from, but he made the most of it.
Yeah.
In fact, he actually named one of his sons Really. So
Really
his
Nolan.
Son's name was Really, Really Truly.
Yeah.
And he named a daughter Sincere Lee.
All right.
Two words.
L-E-I-G-H.
Sincere
right.
Lee.
Yes, right.
Truly.
Yeah.
Sincerely, Nolan. And so it was, I kind of messed that up, but you get the idea.
No, I think, all right. I think you made the point.
And so anyway, he was a great pest control guy. He actually had a lot of great marketing right. ideas, including painting the name. He couldn't afford other kinds of advertising, so he painted his name on old used cars
yeah.
that he would buy and just park.
Yeah.
In obvious places. He lived in Florida, mm-hmm. and in his old age, he had so many Jewish friends that he actually converted to Judaism in his 60s and had his bar mitzvah when he was 68. And he died recently at the age of 89 at his funeral. His daughter, Sincere, praised him for his consistent silliness.
Well, I think there's a lesson in that. I mean, that sounds like a happy life. Praise for his consistent silliness, and you know, it's no substitute for having a sense of humor about yourself. Sometimes it's something you can develop, sometimes it's something you're born with. This fellow Pirsig, you know, wrote a great book. I don't think he had that going for him in terms of that kind of perspective on himself, and perhaps a less happy life as a result. So
possibly.
It feels that way.
Yeah.
All right, two quick points that came up in articles, just things we learned. There's a book called it's an article called The Truth Is Out There, which is about a desk reference called UFO Sightings. That's the UFO.
And that's what it is. It's just statistics.
It lists all the UFO sightings and gives some basic statistics.
By county
across the country.
In the entire U.S.
So I can't go into this at great length. Those interested, you know who you are. But I will just make two observations about this, which kind of stood out. One is that most sightings are in California. And you might say to yourself, well, that's because of the people in California, that's the
are
way
wackos.
They are, right? And the answer they say is no, it's because people in California are outdoors.
It's warm out there, so they're outdoors, looking in the sky.
That's where the UFOs
things.
Are, they're outdoors.
So,
it's
you
a
know,
perfectly good explanation.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're probably missing a lot of UFOs.
That's when they come
because
in.
Because we're inside.
Exactly. And the second point that jumps out at me, which is hard to explain actually, is that the fewest UFO sightings in the United States are in the District of Columbia. And which is very odd, because every time I see a science fiction movie, the first things that the aliens do is they make a beeline
for the Capitol.
The Capitol or the White House. But they're in D.C.
I'm smelling cover up here.
There's no other explanation.
Yeah.
I don't know what it would be. Did you want to say anything about chicken coops?
Chicken Coops, Wall Street Journal has a deluxe selection of chicken coops.
That's only the Wall Street Journal needs could. One. Exactly.
I mean, we have friends like the Walshes who build their own
right.
iconic, beautiful, artisanal
No. They can't measure up to this. They got $4,000 chicken coops.
Yeah, but the Wall Street Journal has some cuties. Well, they're not all $4,000. There's one for $800.
There is.
But the one I liked, the Hobbit Hut, is like $2,000.
Really?
Yeah, it's between $1,000 and $2,000. It's really quite cute. We don't have chickens, so we don't need it yet. But but wouldn't it be nice to have your own chickens, have your own fresh eggs, have your own?
Yeah,
I think it would be nice. But you have to watch out for the chickens, and of course, we have a lot of foxes, so it wouldn't be easy.
Yeah, I mean that is a problem. But listen, I expect these coops are impenetrable. They're Wall Street Journal quality. So foxes wouldn't have a chance. What do you think?
All right. The question is whether you want one you can actually walk in and stand up in and be with the chickens.
Be with the chickens.
And or if you want a chicken height.
Totally unnecessary.
Okay. All right. What else did you
I'm willing to watch the chickens from a distance. So let's go back to Broadway just for a second. We previously covered what we've seen, but here's what's come up.
You sure you want to go back to Broadway?
Yeah, I think so. Did you have something else?
What about your... didn't you see something interesting about soccer and childcare?
Oh, yes.
Stadiums and childcare.
Oh, well, I was going to give the Times a pass, but in the category of...
New York Times doesn't know about sports.
The longest sports story this week happened to be called "This Kindergarten is Noisy at Nap Time." And the story is about, and this is a full page in the New York Times sports section, the lead story, a 30,000-seat German soccer stadium is home to a child care center that some parents choose for coolness reasons. So there's nothing really to say about this except the idea that the Times thinks that this is a sports story. A sports story about a child care center in a stadium in Germany is sort of like a story about the pharmaceutical industry, which is writing about a Duane Reade in Dusseldorf that has a big magazine rack. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Let's just say this. If you're writing an article about sports, New York Times, to the extent you're listening, number one...
Stick to the Longhorn sheep.
Number one, it has to be interesting. Number two, it would be nice if it were useful. But number three, it has to be about sports. And that seems to be the toughest one. Okay, so going back to Broadway developments, there have been a lot of developments. We're just going to cover a couple, three. One is Groundhog Day opened, but the story behind Groundhog Day is this. Groundhog Day opened on a Friday, as most shows do, about a week ago or so. And on the Thursday performance, Andy Carl, who was the lead in Groundhog Day, it was a pretty physical part, leapt up in the air, came down in an odd way, and tore his anterior cruciate ligament in full view of the audience.
His ACL.
And he was in pain. He was in tears. He practically had to be carried off. They had one of those scenes they asked for a doctor. And here was the problem. In order to... This was Wednesday. In order to qualify for the Big Tony Awards... Number one,
to be nominated.
They had to open on that Friday. And number two, he had to be in their performance. I guess it would have been the Thursday night performance that would lead to the reviews that would be written up in the Friday paper. And now on Wednesday night, he had tore his anterior cruciate ligament, putting both the show and his possibility of being nominated completely
at risk. Yeah.
So he had to, with the help of his doctors, I guess, try to get in some kind of condition to go through his paces on Friday. And he did.
He did. He wore a brace.
They made some adjustments. God knows what pills he took. And he got through it. I will tell you, the happy ending is the review that appeared in the Times, based on his performance with the torn and cruciate ligament, was ecstatic. There was an over-the-top review of the show. He might be considered the lead. He's going to compete with the star of the Evan Hansen play for Best Musical Performer. This will compete with Come From Away for Best Play, Most Musical Play. Total triumph. But Tamsin's had knee problems. Tamsin's had a torn ACL. You can just imagine.
And still no Tony.
And still no Tony.
Carl is going to do it.
He's jumping to the head of the class.
I admire him.
All right. So two other plays open that, the best way to describe what's going on here, we have two old plays, Anastasia and Hello, Dolly.
And, well, and you're ignoring Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes, I am.
Which got also bad reviews.
Got bad reviews. But I don't know.
Even though Christian Borle is in it.
Right.
You know, who's awfully good.
Well, yeah.
But so that's too bad.
But here's what's interesting.
But back to Hello, Betty.
Well, Hello, Betty. But let's do Anastasia first. But okay. Here's what we find in this. And we just looking at the Times and the Wall Street Journal. And
because that's all we have time to do. Really.
That's right. But the truth is, they disagree violently about the show. Tams, why don't you read us a snippet from the Anastasia review in the New York Times?
The postcard scenic show that bears her name, that is Anastasia, which opened on Monday night at the Broadhurst Theater, has its own troubling case of personality disorder. Multiple personality disorder. The show in which Anastasia appears trembles nonstop with internal conflicts during its drawn-out 2.5 hours.
Right. And here's the here's what they say in the Wall Street Journal. Anastasia is the real thing, a traditional, fantastical Broadway show, independent of both the animated film and the 1956 film with Ingrid Bergman, which is said to have inspired it. And what they're talking about is the fact that it is drawn from these two sources, and the Ingrid Bergman film and the cartoon. And
the New York Times says it's a mess.
It's a mess because of that. And what the Wall Street Journal says is the result isn't a counter-revolution, or for that matter, a revolution, but it surely deserves some sort of coronation.
So you got to go and decide for yourself.
You got to decide for yourself. We can't decide for you. My guess is it's something in between. My guess is it's Wicked Light, to be perfectly honest with you.
Wicked but Light?
Wicked Light.
Which interesting. Is, okay.
Well, you know, I think that's the target audience. And we'll see. We'll see if people respond to it. But the much bigger noise was made about Hello, Dolly, the much-awaited show starring Bette Midler in the title part.
Again, the Wall Street Journal and the Times disagree.
The Wall Street Journal and the Times. Tams, why don't you read what the Times had to say, which was, read it.
I don't know. What part do you want me to read?
I would read the stuff that's, right there.
Ms. Midler isn't coasting on the goodwill of theatergoers who remember her as the queen of 1980s movie comedies or the bawdy earth goddess of self-satirizing reviews from the 70s onward. She works hard for her ovations, making you feel that the pleasure is all hers. Deftly shoves aside clamorous memories of Carol Channing and Barbara Streisand. Miss Midler's homages are never merely camp. She exuded bone-deep affection and respect for vaudeville stylings, which impeccably controlled artifice as a conduit for sentimentality as well as rowdy humor.
In other words, a rave, rave review. And here's what the Wall Street Journal had to say. Miss Midler's singing voice is in a desperate, sometimes shocking state of disrepair. I'm not sure whether she's suffering from an acute case of laryngitis, her speaking voice was hoarse as well, or the inescapable effects of age at 71. Miss Midler doesn't even bother to act. She simply comes on stage and plays her familiar self, albeit at a disturbingly low level of energy. She can't dance. She isn't funny. I was embarrassed by her mugging. All she has to offer is the memory of a great career. And if that's enough for you, then you'll be happy to shell out to see her in Hello, Dolly.
And what the Times would say in response to that is Ms. Midler's talents have never included a conventionally pretty voice. Yet when she rasps out the anthem before the parade passes by, you hear her voice as that of a nightingale. And she hikes up her period skirts to shuffle her feet. She gives the impression that she's dancing up a storm. She's not, of course. Her kicks and her big numbers are only from the knees. But a great star performance is at least 50% illusion, conjured by irresistible will, power, and cunning.
Well, that's fascinating. You can see they're seeing the same show, but they're getting different things out of it. That's to be sure. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
so,
funny.
Again.
But it's an easy call. If you're a Bette Midler fan, go.
Sell one of your cars.
Right.
And get some tickets.
And if you're not, don't. If you're a Bette Midler fan, go. All right, so that pretty much brings us toward the end. I think we just wanted to end to go back with where we started, with Present Laughter and Noel Coward. Most of you are familiar with Noel Coward as a playwright, but also he was a songwriter, poet, if that's what you want to call it. Some would call it doggerel, but it's fun. And let me just close with a few lines from his poem slash song.
With this weekend in mind, where we had 87 degrees yesterday, it's even here in Pennsylvania.
Mad Dogs and Englishmen. I'm just going to read one stanza. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to. The Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines sleep firmly from 12 to 1. In the Philippines, there are lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay states, there are hats like plates, which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 noon, the natives swoon and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun.
So that's all for today.
And, oh, one final note. Zeke, out there in Santa Monica.
Shout out to Zeke.
Happy birthday,
Zeke.
Stay off the beaches in the midday sun. But happy birthday. And we'll see you next week at Tamsin and Dan Read the Papers.
All right.